Welcome to the Prioritizing Prevention, Translating Science to Practice podcast. Our goal is to prioritize prevention conversations that matter. Our topic for today is man therapy and beyond, practical strategies for male mental wellness, with special guest Daniel Bennett and Kelly Berry. Now, here's our host, Holly Raffle.
Hello, listeners. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to give you an alert. What we're about to discuss touches on some really important but also potentially sensitive areas. Specifically, we'll be talking about suicide and other aspects of men's mental health. Now, your well-being is paramount to us here at the show. We understand that these topics can be tough. And if you find yourself feeling overwhelmed or triggered by anything we discuss, please know that you're not alone and there's support available. If you or someone you know is struggling, please reach out. You can connect with a mental health professional or call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. That number is easy to remember. It's 988. That's 988. There are people there who are ready and willing to help. Okay, with that important note said, let's get into the show. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of season 3 on Prioritizing Prevention, Translating Science to Practice. This podcast is hosted by the Ohio Center of Excellence for Behavioral Health Prevention and Promotion. My name is Holly Raffle, and I have the privilege of serving as the faculty director of the center. With May being Mental Health Awareness Month and June right around the corner as Men's Health Month, it's a crucial time to talk about well-being for everyone. This month, we're focusing on the workplace. Now, we all know that mental health impacts individuals, but it also significantly affects our workplaces. Healthy employees mean a healthy organization. We're seeing some interesting generational differences too, with many leaders coming at a time when prioritizing health wasn't the norm, leading to some discomfort around mental health discussions at work. Even though the pandemic highlighted these issues, there's still a lot of ground to cover. That's why we're thrilled to bring you a conversation today with two experts who can shed light on men's mental health and its impact in the workplace. Please welcome Daniel Bennett from the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation and Kelly Berry from 1 in 5 in Cincinnati. And to give you a little more insight into who we'll be speaking with, Daniel is the Director of Statewide Prevention and Expansion at the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation. He supports the ongoing growth and development of Ohio's network of suicide prevention coalitions. In addition, he serves as an ambassador for the LifeSite Ohio campaign, is a regional trainer for sources of strength, and provides QPR, question, persuade, refer, gatekeeper training. Daniel also works on advocacy and legislation issues, organizing OSPS partners to help advocate for suicide prevention. He's an Ohio certified prevention consultant, having worked previously in school-based suicide prevention and coalition work. Welcome, Daniel. We're so glad you're here today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're also joined by Kelly Berry. Kelly is a senior program manager in the corporate space at 1 in 5, a Cincinnati-based nonprofit that focuses on mental health education, stigma reduction, and suicide prevention. Kelly is a public health educator with 15 years of experience in corporate wellness and an expert in evidence-based stress coping and resiliency. She has a bachelor's in public health from Clemson University and a master's in health promotion and health education from the University of Cincinnati. She's a certified health education specialist, a national board certified health and wellness coach, and a certified QPR suicide prevention gatekeeper instructor. Kelly works to support employee mental health with individual and systems level approaches to keep both individuals and organizations thriving. Thank you for joining us, Kelly.
Excited to be here.
Now, as you know, we love to go a little deeper with our guests than just the standard bio. So, Daniel, Kelly, we'd love for you to share a little something about yourselves beyond your official titles and your bios. Maybe a glimpse into what a typical day looks like, what part of your work really lights you up, or even just a little personal tidbit that our listeners might connect with. Who would like to start?
Go, Daniel.
Sure. So the question on a typical day for me is really tricky. That's one of the really nice things about my job is there is a lot of variety to the work that I do. One day I might be visiting gun shops and doing some advocacy around firearm safety and suicide prevention. I might be hanging out at a coalition meeting and just kind of providing some support there. I got the opportunity a couple weeks ago to connect with the Akron Rubber Ducks and get some suicide prevention messaging up in their ballpark. And then occasionally, maybe I'm attending a legislative meeting or connecting with some of our county and state partners in lawmaking. So there's really a lot of variety to my job, which that and the ability to connect with a lot of people really makes it, you know, it makes my days go quickly. There's certainly a lot to do, but I do enjoy being able to connect with a variety of people.
Thanks, Daniel. How about you, Kelly?
I would say similarly to Daniel, I had a colleague who referred to our kind of work that we do as Swiss Army knives, where we're kind of jack of all trades. And I think that's probably the nature of most prevention and public health spaces. We just get pulled into different things. And I would say for me that keeps it interesting and keeps it fun. Like Daniel, I can be, on a construction job site one day and with healthcare workers the next day. I think probably my favorite piece of my career is just getting to go into different industries and hear people's stories. And I think that really helps inform the work that we do, that we're connecting to people so that what we do resonates, you know, on a personal level.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for sharing. Just knowing what your day looks like and how you approach your work really helps us understand the passion that you bring to this work. So building on that, let's delve into the core discussion for today, men's mental health and workplace well-being. We know that mental health disorders do not discriminate. They impact individuals across the lifespan. We also know that men are less likely to receive mental health treatment than women, in part because they face different barriers to addressing mental health concerns, such as societal expectations around masculinity, stigma, and a lack of awareness about available resources. Nearly 1 in 10 men experience some form of depression or anxiety. Death by suicide among men in 2023 was approximately 4 times higher than it was for women. To reiterate that point, men make up 50% of the population, but account for nearly 80% of deaths by suicide. Daniel, could you share your perspective on the unique factors that make focusing on men's mental health particularly important?
Absolutely. I think you summed a little bit of it up, Holly, when you talked about the stigma piece. There is this persistent stigma in the male community that it's not okay to talk about mental health, or that there's going to be judgment there, or that's a sign of weakness. Men tend to be stubborn about things when it comes to our health, even our physical health, to the point that especially older generations would rather not know if they've got an illness. They'd rather just try to deal with it on their own, or they just, you know, they don't go into the doctor for anything. I remember a meme I saw where it was a billboard that said, men don't go to the doctor because they're stubborn. And it was a ad to go and get checked out for like prostate cancer. And then at the bottom, someone had spray painted, no, we're not. And it's so just kind of like highlights that idea that even when, you know, we're being told, hey, these are the consequences of not getting help for healthcare, that we still don't go and get checked out for those kind of things. So that stigma piece is really a big part of it, because if you're worried that other people are going to judge you for what you're experiencing, or if it's going to affect your job, or if it's going to affect your relationships, you're probably not very likely to go and get that help. And then when it leads to risk there for suicide, we also know that men are a lot more likely to use a firearm when it comes to suicide attempts. And firearm suicides, overwhelmingly, if someone chooses a gun for a suicide attempt, they generally do end up dying from that attempt. And we are actually, unfortunately, seeing an increase in some areas where women are more likely to maybe turn to firearms than they were in the past. But there still is that significantly higher risk of death there for men with a firearm. So that does play into the factor for suicide, not being willing to talk about it, not going and getting the help that we need, not feeling like maybe we're worthy of that help sometimes is an issue as well. And you kind of combine all that with this generational feeling like the only emotions men are allowed to experience are anger or happiness, then you kind of build like this perfect storm where guys just don't go and get the help they need.
Thanks, Daniel. And I really appreciate how you talked about societal factors, personal factors, but also access and availability factors when it comes to men's mental health, and particularly men's suicide. I think all of those issues are difficult to look at in isolation, but when you put it as that sort of quote, perfect storm, right? It makes a whole lot more sense. And it means that we need a whole lot of different strategies for prevention.
I think, too, one of the things that we see is that a lot of our behavioral health providers are women, and a man may not feel as comfortable going and opening up in that environment. We've talked for years about the need to expand the behavioral health field so that we have access to counselors that reflect, you know, our personal values or how we see ourselves. And if men don't feel comfortable talking about their mental health, and then they can't find a therapist they connect with, they're probably almost never going to go and get the help that they may need.
Absolutely. And Kelly, when you think about workplace wellness, it too is often focused on physical health, like gym memberships and healthy vending options. But accessibility is really important there. So how are we seeing this landscape shift to more explicitly include mental well-being in workplace wellness? And what are the key drivers behind this evolution?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that trend. I think the biggest driver is around retention and engagement, where we've seen a really significant drop in that internal workforce. One of the statistics around mental health engagement is that half of all full-time employees have left a job for mental health reasons. And then when we look at those generational trends, it's 68% of millennials, 81% of Gen Z. And when we look at forecasting data for Gen Alpha, which is, you know, the kids today, little kids today, they're expecting that the number one thing that that generation will look for in the workplace is mental health support. And so, I feel like, you know, when I started early in my career, it started as it's just the right thing to do to protect people. And then, you know, I think in the workplace, you got to speak the language of the people that you're working with, which is oftentimes HR and the C-suite. And many of them do care very deeply about the individuals in their workforce, but it is a business. And so I think framing it up as this is costing you, not, you know, retention, engagement, and truly attraction as well. I mean, it's a workforce sustainability piece. If we're not normalizing these conversations and normalizing support, we lose people, and that has huge impacts.
Absolutely. And I think framing is something really important that I'd like to dive deeper with you, Kelly, is I've been familiar with the concept of absenteeism as a leader, you know, and that's simply when someone's not at work for a variety of reasons. But I recently heard of a new to me concept called presenteeism. And it feels like that might be appropriate for today's conversation. So can you talk a little bit about what presenteeism is and if the employers you work with are also concerned about this issue?
Yeah, I think it's a more common known term in the HR space and human resources. Presenteeism really describes someone who is physically present, but mentally somewhere else. And so obviously that's something that we see a lot when we talk about the stress response. And I think I want to say two things when we talk about mental health. I mean, we know the statistics around mental illness that we're looking at now for adults. 1 to 4 every year, 1 in 3 for 18 to 25 year olds. Universally, all of us experience mental health, and all of us go through seasons where we're kind of living in a stress response place. And so that's not a, you know, us versus them or however people identify if they've experienced these seasons with mental illness. That stress response is physical, and it creates kind of changes in how we show up and in our engagement. And, you know, I think when we're talking about presenteeism specifically, especially in industries where safety is really foundational, like healthcare or construction, that's really dangerous and can be life and death. And so really, really important to target and be intentional to create, I would say, create more systems around how we target how people show up. And I kind of going back to your earlier question about trends, I think we're starting to see a trend with this, but I think historically, the trends in employee wellness, when we talk about stress and self-care, and I use kind of air quotes there because I know that term kind of gets muddled sometimes, but it's been a figure out your stuff. That's a you problem. It's not an us problem. And we know that we as human beings don't live in a vacuum. We also know that there was a psychologist that I heard with this analogy around burnout, that blaming burnout on the individual is sort of like blaming a candle for going out in a storm, that oftentimes there are a lot of environmental factors. And so I think it's really important with presenteeism, engagement with a lot of things, we can't put it all on the individual. We need to look at those system level approaches. And I, you know, as a nerdy public health person, I go back to that like socio-ecological model of like, all right, let's hit all those spheres going out to make sure that we can have the best impact.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kelly. And I think that goes back to Daniel's point, right? It's rarely one thing, and it's not a faucet that we can kind of turn on and off. Rather, people's absenteeism or presenteeism or mental health, it's often a cascade of multiple events across multiple areas of their life, which is why instead of looking for one single solution, we probably should be looking towards a framework with multiple solutions. And we saw that from the U.S. Surgeon General in 2022 as they released a framework specifically for the workplace called Workplace Mental Health and Wellbeing. And it recognized that more and more workers are experiencing exactly what you described. They're worried about making ends meet, dealing with chronic stress, struggling to balance the demands of work and personal lives. And this document really kind of focuses on the importance of creating a culture of caring in the workplace. It emphasizes that when people thrive at work, they are more likely to feel physically and mentally healthy overall and contribute positively to their workplace, which probably spills over into their life at large. Translating this framework, though, into actionable steps requires exploring a lot of tools and initiatives that can support workplace mental health. And to our listeners, there are many things workplaces can do. It's kind of analyzing what your workplace needs and choosing the right strategies that match what's going on in your particular setting. Daniel, Man Therapy Ohio is an initiative that's relatively new to Ohio's behavioral health community, and the title is definitely attention-grabbing. And while our understanding is that it wasn't specifically created for work sites, it is one of several powerful tools that employers can use to start the conversation about men's mental health. Can you take a moment to tell us about it, like how it got started, who the campaign partners are, and how it's specifically tailored to men?
Yeah, absolutely. Man Therapy is one of my favorite campaigns that we run here in Ohio, and it's also run in other states. It was originally created in Colorado. It's been around for about 10-ish years. We actually ran a little bit of Man Therapy Ohio work in Ohio, maybe couple years before the pandemic, but it's been really rebranded and revamped in the last year or so, and relaunched across Ohio. The great thing about Man Therapy Ohio is it takes in humor and brings it into the mental health space. And that's really disarming for a lot of men who traditionally don't feel comfortable talking about mental health. And I will tell you that Man Therapy isn't for everybody. I know some people in the mental health space that have said, like, I just don't get it. I don't know why we talk about humor when we're talking about suicide. And that I understand that. But for the folks that it does resonate with, it really works. And the name might make you think like, oh, Man Therapy, like I'm going to sit down and have a conversation with a counselor. Really, what the campaign does is it takes these humorous ways to step into the space around mental health. There are videos, there are billboards. There are different like posters and things that can be printed out. We've got coasters for bars. There's all kinds of different ways the message can get out there. An individual sees it. Maybe it catches their attention. It makes them laugh. They want to find out more. they go on to the Man Therapy website. And then on the website, they can actually take, it's called a head inspection on their website. It's really just a self-assessment. So it gives an individual an opportunity to, one, jump into the space they might not normally be into, and then two, kind of assess how they're doing with their own mental health. And interestingly enough, it is marketed and targeted towards men, and we do get a lot of men who check the site out. But then also, it has, we've seen that a lot of women will go onto the site as well because they're worried about men in their lives. They want to get some more information and resources. And then the site can connect you with national and state specific resources that can cater towards men if somebody does need additional help. They complete that head inspection and it'll tell you, hey, things are going pretty well right now. Or maybe it's not a good idea to have a conversation further with a mental health professional or expert in that space. So it really, it's almost like going in for that quick checkup with your doctor, and then they can say, hey, things look like they're going well, or maybe it's a good idea to kind of further talk about this with a specialist. So I love the campaign. A lot of our coalitions across the state of Ohio are running with it. You may see Man Therapy billboards up. They're one of those campaigns that are up and running right now in the Akron Rubber Ducks stadium that I mentioned. So it's a really good way to get involved there. You mentioned it's not employer specific, but Man Therapy does have a lot of different campaign materials that can be adjusted. So they've got sports specific ones. They've got one specific to go into casinos around gambling. They do have some business specific things as well. So even though it's not necessarily created for that business community, it can be tailored to fit really any environment.
Can I add that?
Absolutely.
I'm obsessed with Man Therapy Ohio. I am such a huge advocate of it. So of the those who do get it, I think it's fantastic. And if you haven't seen it, it is, if you've seen the show Parks and Recreation, it's based on the character Ron Swanson. One of their Dr. Rich Mahogany, who's in a lot of videos. So I have found it to be a really effective way to kind of break the ice when I've gone into, we're in a lot of construction industry things. And so it's been a great way to kind of ease the tension when you're starting a conversation around something that may feel taboo or really tense to talk about. And kind of to echo Daniel's point around they have a share drive with a ton of fantastic resources that some of them are industry specific. Like they've got some for first responders, some for construction, a number of different things. I would say my favorite one is their bathroom signs that have a QR code on them. And I was talking to someone, I think one of the researchers that's studying this, and they've seen really fantastic results. I think it's out of the University of Maryland, but that they've seen really significant kind of feedback and the, I guess, impacts of marketing by putting them in bathroom stalls because, you know, men are more likely to, you have a captive audience and they're less likely to, you know, if it's up in a break room or in a hallway and you see you're taking a screenshot of it, you know, if there is that stigma there, then there may be this, I don't want anyone to see that I'm looking at this resource. So it's a really subtle way to, with humor, to get people to think a little bit more deeply about their own mental health, but I'm a huge fan of it.
But Kelly, you mentioned the QR codes. One of the really great things I love about Man Therapy being in the prevention space is that they can take that QR code and let you know how many people from your county went onto the website, how many people from your county clicked on pages, how many pages they went on, did they take the head inspection. It won't give any personal details. So like, it's not going to say so-and-so scored this way on the head inspection, but it'll at least let us know that when I'm taking the time and the energy and the effort to get these materials out there, that the community is responding to it and they're using it. And it's completely free too. So any agency, any group across the state of Ohio can use Man Therapy Ohio. There's no additional cost for that unless there's some printing cost.
Thanks, Daniel. And would local coalitions be putting up their own QR code, or how does that work and how can they request those statistics?
if we're looking for the statistics there, the way that we run that is through, as Kelly mentioned, the University of Maryland. They've got an evaluation team that's working on it with us. And they did the same thing in a couple other states. And so they can reach out to myself or Jason Hughes on our team at OSPF. And then Jason and I can get them connected with the full Google Drive with all the resources on it. And then the team there will actually create a QR code specific for them so that they can track that data for them. And we've had some of our, especially some of our rural counties that have used that, have been able to get data on who's engaging and how many touch points they're getting that they don't normally have access to. So I'd highly recommend, if you are going to run the campaign, request that QR code so that you can get that data back to you.
And so is it only available for coalitions to do countywide, or say, like, I'm an employer and like Worthington Industries in Columbus, and I want to put up Man Therapy in all of, you know, our spaces, et cetera. Can a specific employer get a QR code and track their employees?
We haven't gone down to that level yet, but I'm sure that we could. It would be just a matter of getting them the unique QR code. So we just have to get them connected. But yeah, we could go for a business to get that set up for sure.
Yeah, especially a large one, right? Where confidentiality is least of a concern than a small business that has like 6 employees.
Sure. But even if we did that smaller business, it would just show, hey, we had 6 engagements. Or maybe if it's a retail location, maybe customers are using it too. So they may end up finding that more folks are coming in and scanning the QR code than they realized.
That's a great point. And Daniel, I'm remembering that OSPF offers additional free resources for employers. Like, I think there's an employee toolkit.
There is. And actually, the employee toolkit just got a revamp. It's available on our website, ohiospf.org. Again, that is totally free. It has templates in there so that employers can create policies. It has forms for HR. The newest addition to it is we added some postvention policies and language. And for folks who may not be familiar, postvention is how a business or a region responds after a suicide. And good postvention work can actually reduce risk for further suicides if people are affected by that loss. One of the things that we found is that if you've got those policies already laid out in that handbook before you have a loss, the way that it impacts your community and your employees is going to be vastly different than if a workplace is trying to deal with the loss after a suicide and they don't have that in place. So we highly recommend that employers check that out. And like I said, everything on there is free to use. And then there's also, it's also adaptable too. So you can make some changes to those policies that best fit your agency.
Thank you so much, Dana. We really appreciate that. And to our listeners, if you're in the car or you're out on your daily walk, know that we will put all of these resources in the show notes so you don't have to worry about trying to remember them or drop them in the notes feature of your phone. So, Kelly, I know that you have been successful in building relationships with employers with the intention of eventually connecting them to mental and behavioral health resources that already exist and in many cases may be free for them to use. So how have you been successful in connecting workplaces with things like QPR, gatekeeper trainings, mental health first aid certifications, 988 information, things like Man Therapy, and of course, Ohio's new Recovery Friendly Worksite initiative?
Oh, I think that's tricky. It's probably not rocket science. A lot of it is just relationship building, is getting to know people. And I think they're, you know, operating from a sense of humility and curiosity that I may be the expert in this space, but I don't know their people. I don't know their industry. I don't know how they tick. And so, you know, the work when 1 in 5 works with different organizations, it truly is a partnership where we're kind of coming together. I have found that there is a bit of a educational or sales piece with the work that we do, because I think people are very familiar with more of the tertiary support, the, you know, EAP, mental health benefits. But I'm going to botch this statistic. I want to say NAMI or Mental Health America did a study and found that something like only 25% of employees knew about their internal mental health resources. And so a lot of the times it's, you know, we're kind of coming in and helping employers connect, you know, their people with what they already have in place. I think another asset is kind of two things. One, you sort of have to learn the language of the industry that you're stepping into and learn what really matters to them and what makes them tick so that you can meet them where they're at. With that being said, I think, you know, we have general workplace statistics, but anytime we can pull in relevant industry-specific statistics, because I think sometimes there is this perception of, well, that we don't have that problem. and when you can come out and say, you know, this is really what we found industry-wide for your industry, then it kind of highlights it in a different way. So that aspect of things with that educational component, I think conferences have been really effective for us, being able to speak at different conferences like HR conferences. So getting in spaces where essentially what we're doing is a little bit of like employee training. And so it's just figuring out and who to talk to and speaking in a language that really resonates with them. And obviously that's going to be different depending on the space that you're in. So it's a little, there's some nuance to
it. Absolutely. It sounds like it's definitely, you have a toolkit, but not a cookbook in order to build those relationships.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
So, and I think the EAP or employee assistance programs are one of the greatest underutilized resource that employers have, and they're paying for it, right? And so it's important to let folks know, hey, here is what your benefits are. And sometimes those long waiting times people have to seek mental health care can be alleviated with you know, some EAPs offer up to 5 you know, mental health or wellness coaching sessions that can be used not only for the employee, but I know I can speak for Ohio University where it's good for your family as well.
Pretty standard for it to be anyone in your household. So even people that, you know, anyone that's living under your roof, which is certainly very helpful. And I think also there's a lot of misconceptions about EAP. Prior to 1 in 5, I worked in a healthcare system. And so anytime that, you know, people are like, are they going to be able to see my electronic medical data? I don't want my employer to find this out. I'm always really intentional to clarify how we talk about EAP, that it is different than medical benefits in that the only thing that's reported back to the employer is aggregate data. So they only know, like, you know, we had 4 people who called last month. They never know who. They don't know themes. So I think it's really important to just clarify that it is completely anonymous. And I think also one of the other big things that we find helpful with that is training leaders to talk about EAP or other mental health benefits the way that they would any other benefit, your PTO, your, you know, vision or dental or whatever, that mental health is physical health. Even just kind of clarifying, I had a colleague years ago who used to say, I use all of my sessions every year just to vent about work. That is a totally appropriate utilization of EAP. We don't have to wait until we're in this crisis mode. It is okay to have a third party that you're connecting to help process through things before we get into this, I'm in desperate need of support space. So I think that kind of helps is giving them some tools on how to present those to employees so that it feels a little bit more human to talk about them.
100%. And I love framing the EAP just like we do paid time off or PTO. Ohio's worksite sector varies in purpose and scope, even within individual worksites, and the range of job duties Ohioans engage in is very vast, which often is a barrier to creating policies that support mental and physical health and wellness, because it's really difficult to come up with a one-size-fits-all. So if changing policies to support mental, emotional, or behavioral health isn't feasible, what other supports do you think could be put in place to create that culture of caring that is supportive to employees and their mental health?
Yeah, it's not black and white. And I think even just we did a webinar with an HR consulting firm and a law firm just around accommodations, employee accommodations, because we're seeing an uptick in requests for accommodations around mental health. And the language of ADA, Americans with Disability Act, is very vague because it really is meant to be a conversation, that it's not meant to be one size fits all, because people are not one size fits all. So I think how we create a culture of caring is, there's a lot of research that points to training your people leaders to recognize signs and symptoms of mental health challenges, and then how to support those employees without stepping into a space where they're becoming a therapist or a healthcare provider or even trying to fix it. And so, kind of teaching one of the strategies we typically go with is teaching your people leaders, whether that's supervisors or C-suite or whatever, if you're over a team of people, coaching strategies. So sort of how to partner with them. And we always use the analogy of like a crossing guard, where you're walking alongside them to help them get connected to help and support in a way that really matters to them. So I think that's probably our biggest recommendation. And, Holly, you were talking about the toolkit from the U.S. Surgeon General. And I think even the World Health Organization created a big recommendation, and the recommendation with the greatest level of evidence, like their highest recommendation, was to train organizational leaders. And so I think when we're creating a culture, that's really where it comes from. It's that, are our leaders normalizing these behaviors in themselves? If you have a C-suite of individuals who are talking about their own mental health experiences in a very normal human way, that's going to change the culture and impact the culture of that organization faster than any policy or anything else can do. It's normalizing being human.
Absolutely. And I think that really hits home the points I've heard from both you and Daniel today, is that when we're talking about health in the workplace or talking about connecting with populations, like specifically men and men's health, it's that connection, right? And it's not this certain tool or here's all these free things. It's coming, making a connection with that individual first, and then providing the resources second. Did I get that right from both of you?
I would say, yeah. And I would add to it that connection piece. I think especially in the workplace, there's been this historical, I don't want to overstep, I don't want to say the wrong thing, I'm just not going to say anything at all. And we know that that leaves people hurting for much longer and in isolation, and oftentimes are more likely to end up in a mental health crisis as a result of that isolation. And so that human connection piece, I think I really think it's one of the most protective factors out there. And so if we can train people to connect with people around them, obviously in the workplace, in the community, in their families, and I think the language that we always kind of lean on with that is like, I'm noticing and I'm wondering, because it's very objective. It's, hey, I'm noticing that you used to come in and hang out with everyone and be really engaged in these things. And I'm noticing that you're keeping to yourself and you seem a little down, and I'm noticing kind of changes in how you're showing up. I'm wondering if everything's okay. But sort of normalizing not that we haven't cared about people in the past, but normalizing leaning into, I think, the awkwardness of saying, hey, I'm seeing something different. Because I care, I want to check in. Are you okay? What's going on? Rather than, hey, how are you doing? Which are kind of, we default to that autopilot response of, I'm fine, even when we're not. So, yes to the connection piece. Absolutely.
And Daniel, in your introduction, you even talk about how much connection you do on a daily basis.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I fully echo what Kelly said about the connectivity piece. It is probably the most impactful protective factor when it comes to suicide, is just, are we connected there? But I think it falls into a lot of different levels. One is, do I have people I can turn to that I can talk to? But it's also, like Kelly said, do I have people around me that are going to notice those changes, that are going to be able to step in and do something if something is not quite right? I think if we can build those connections, whether it's through work, whether it's through our friends and our family, if we build those connections, and then we also know what to do when something's wrong. I think that's the biggest piece for a lot of folks, is I'm afraid to ask if you're struggling because I don't know the mental health resources, or I don't know what's the next right step in that situation. And I think, especially, I mean, for the general public, that's an issue, but I think for HR folks, that's an issue. I know we've all gone to the doctors recently, and they ask you those three or four questions about, have you been depressed lately? And I know a lot of folks we work with in primary care settings say, yeah, we ask the questions, but then we don't even know what resources in the community to send them to. And that it makes us very nervous to engage in that way. So just know what resources in your area. We've mentioned 988 a couple of times. You don't have to be in crisis to call 988. You can call 988 just to ask them what resources are around you. Or you can call them because you're worried about somebody else. I know some of the statistics in the past, about 70% of people call the crisis lines are not actively suicidal. It's open, it's available. So if you're dealing with any kind of struggle or you're looking for help for somebody, 988 and 211 are great resources to find places we can get people help.
Absolutely. Thank you both. I could continue this conversation all day, but it's getting to that place where we've got to park this bus. Our listeners are done with their quick work break, and we want to get them back to their next activity. But before we let you go, we always like to end with a few this or that question. These are just your quick thoughts only. There's no right or wrong answer. And I have a couple of questions here to keep with our theme today. So when it comes to tackling workplace stress, is your choice a quiet walk outdoors or a quick guided meditation? How about you, Daniel?
Definitely a quick walk outdoors for me. I'm engaged in the LifeSide campaign because I like to be out in nature. I like to hunt. I like to go fishing. So I'm taking that one every day.
How about you, Kelly?
I'm with you there, Daniel. I'm an outdoor girl. That is my happy place. So I would much rather get outside. Tried to get into the meditation thing, and it is a struggle.
So my next question is about resources at work. Openly talking about mental health at work or having more anonymous support options available?
Can I go with both? We talked about it not being a one-size-fits-all approach. I think some people are never going to engage in the conversation that's open because they're still worried about those stigmas. And anonymous stuff like those bathroom QR codes are going to work really well for them. And I think other people are a little bit more gregarious and will happily tell you everything going on in their lives. And that's going to be a better fit for them.
I don't think I can answer that any better. You started talking, I was like, oh, that's a way better answer than what I was going to say.
Sounds like it's unanimous there. And our last question is a question we ask every single one of our guests. You are reaching into that candy dish. Are you looking for a plain or peanut M&M?
Peanut butter.
Oh, peanut butter. A little bit different than the peanut, still tasty though. How about you, Daniel?
I think of the two choices, I'll go with the plain, but if Kelly's bringing the peanut butter M&Ms, I'll do those ones.
Absolutely. Thank you both for sharing your time and experience with us. Thank you to our listeners for joining us on the Ohio Center of Excellence for Behavioral Health Prevention and Promotion podcast, Prioritizing Prevention. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating, sharing with others, posting about it on social media, or setting the podcast to automatically download on your favorite channel. Doing so helps us reach more listeners and keeps the conversation going. To catch all the latest from the Center, follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, and Facebook at OH Prevention COE, or visit us at preventioncoe.ohio.gov to sign up for our monthly newsletter. If you missed our last podcast, it was with Robin, one of Ohio's regional learning collaborative leaders for the Ohio Adult Allies program, and a youth leader, Riley. During our conversation, we discussed key distinctions between prevention for youth and youth-led prevention. We also identified the benefits of youth-led prevention and outlined effective strategies for sustaining youth-led prevention programs. This podcast was produced by Ivory Lloyd at Global Insight Productions and is supported by Ziyu Zhang and Jen Morell at the Ohio Center of Excellence for Behavioral Health Prevention and Promotion. Thank you for all your work to get positive prevention content out in the world.
This has been the Prioritizing Prevention podcast. For more episodes, you can find us on Spotify, YouTube, Google Play, Apple Music, and many more. This program is funded by the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. For more information about us, please visit preventioncoe.ohio.gov. Thank you for listening.